Welcome back to Studio A. I'm Roland Lettner. And Uwe, thanks for staying with us and continuing to discuss this new memoir of yours about Vietnam called Duc.
Thanks, Roland.
As we went to the break, the notion about the inability of the South to fight, were they really that bad?
It was. No. I was in combat with many Vietnamese units, as well as American and Korean and others, and I found some of the Vietnamese units outstanding. Of one division that I have in mind, the 23rd Infantry Division in Vietnam, you might have, say, the 44th Brigade being terrible, or regiment rather, being terrible, and the 45th being brilliant. Why is this? Well, very simply, the Vietnamese didn't have all this rotation system where the Americans had were officers after spending 12 months, or normal regular soldiers, NCOs, spend 12 months in country and then were moved back states. No, they were, for them, the war went on and on and on. So when you saw a bad South Vietnamese unit, there was no surprise in it. They lost all their officers in combat. So they had to first train more NCOs and junior officers to take over companies. So to say that the South Vietnamese were not willing to fight is absolutely it's a calumny. And I found this, while I was in Vietnam, quite disagreeable. This almost racist attitude that some of my colleagues, not all of my colleagues, some of my colleagues said vis-a-vis the Vietnamese because they weren't such good fighters. Well, they weren't good fighters because they were not led. They lost their men, which happens in a war. So these things occurred. Another thing that occurred is somehow some members of the American and Western press fell for the communist propaganda. Now, people like Neil Sheehan and Stanley Kano, who became famous for their opposition to the war, were informed by a guy, wrote on the basis of information from a guy who served Reuters wire service as an interpreter. Now, the chief of bureau, Saigon chief of bureau of Reuters, knew that this man was a Viet Cong agent. In fact, he later turned out to be a colonel in the North Vietnamese Army. The Reuters chief of bureau was British, told everybody, look, this is a commie, but I mean, I keep him on staff because as long as I know who he is, and first of all, I get forward to him some information from the other side, which I have to then obviously sort out very carefully, but and work responsibly with them. But you don't buy his stuff. And of course, he needed interpreters. But these very, very famous American journalists based their judgment on information they received from this guy of Viet Cong. This, by the way, is not something that I'm cooking up here. I'm saying this is something that was known in Saigon, and it became, it was even admitted later here in this country, but it seems to totally have been disregarded. We faced an enemy over there. It's not my enemy because I'm not an American citizen, but we saw the other side operate in a manner very similar to the SS and the Nazis. And it was a totalitarian regime, and leading members of the American press, not the entirety of the American press corps, one has to be very, very careful there, but prominent American journalists sympathized with the other side, who made it possible for the wrong side to win.
We've been talking almost exclusively about the war in Vietnam, but let's divert for a moment, because the book isn't just about that. Tell me about the Vietnam that enchanted you, that wove itself into your memory and endeared itself to you.
You know, this is one of the most it was one of the most wonderful places to be in. The French had a way of creating beautiful colonies and beautiful cities. Saigon was a lovely town, it still is, I suppose. I haven't been there since the war, but it was a lovely town. It was a perfect admixture of the French civilization. We're not talking about politics now, we're just talking about culture. And the Vietnamese civilization, a highly cultured Asian civilization. And the two were a perfect match, too. So when you attended a dinner party or a social function, first of all, in those days, French was still the lingua franca, everybody spoke French, even Vietnamese among each other spoke French. There was wonderful food. There was wonderful music. There was good theater. It was cultured beyond belief. It was, the streets were beautifully laid out. There were marvelous sidewalk cafes. There were very, very good French and Vietnamese and Chinese restaurants, Chinese being the third important culture there, or second actually in terms of numbers. Large, large Chinese colony. So there was that. Then there was the physical beauty of people, and I happen to be a man, and I, of the old-fashioned type, I do love beautiful women, and I love to look at them, and there's nothing more beautiful than looking out my window and seeing those, that stream of these delicious creatures in their marvelous gowns called owl's eyes, walking down Tudor Street. I mean, it was aesthetically such a fantastic beauty. Then you had the humor. I mean, the Vietnamese women who look so fragile, frangible, so willowy, actually are very bawdy lots. I mean, they're funny, they're quite physical, they could be good Lutherans, they all sound like Lutherans, and very well, and then you had, strangely enough, the Vietnamese men who are still tend to be rather withdrawn. They are sort of Confucianist scholar types, thinkers, dreamers. The women run the show, the women run the business. I am quite sure that politics were run by women, and I know who were the most successful women politicians in town. Sister Law were incredibly powerful in scheming. So it was phenomenal. And then, of course, you must understand that is, we're talking about a country of huge physical beauty. I describe in one of my chapters, earlier chapters, the old imperial capital of Hue, which was ravished by later on in, during the Tet Offensive. But when I first got there, if you had any sense of the local culture, you would sleep in what was called a sampan hotel, and that you there was a sampan, and there was a boatman, and a very beautiful woman with a sort of guitar or lute-shaped instrument would sit at the bow of the ship, and then we would float out into the river of perfumes, and she would sing and sing and sing, very haunting with very sensuous songs, until you fell asleep. And that was that. But all this, I'm quite sure, has disappeared now in ugly forms of tourism. But in those days, it was enchanting beyond belief. It was, you know, I was received by the Dowager Empress of Vietnam. The extent of the culture and delicacy of these people was breathtaking, all of which, of course, has vanished because of this war and because of, I think, finally, America's surrender to a really very, very evil doctrine, namely the doctrine of Marxism-Leninism. There were beaches. And there's a lovely scene that you will read about. For example, I sat in a military, American military airplane, wedged in between a South Vietnamese soldier who carried a cage with a canary. And he'd come back from R&R, rest and recuperation. And on that, he was on my left, and on the right was an American GI, also coming back from R&R in Thailand. And I developed a conversation, since I speak French, and the Vietnamese soldier knew French well and didn't speak any English. I actually acted as an interpreter between the Vietnamese and the American. And the two stories they had, the Vietnamese had been in combat, then had been called back because his father was slaughtered, massacred, and his mother was slaughtered, massacred by the Viet Cong. And his brother had already fallen in combat. And so he had to go back to bury them. And then the only thing, and of course their house was burnt down and everything, and it really massacred everything. And the only thing that survived, which a neighbor had rescued, was this canary. So, like many Vietnamese soldiers, he went into combat carrying a canary cage. That was one thing. Now, on the other side, and the Americans listened to it, and what a tragic story. But then the American had another story to tell. The American also had been in R&R, given R&R, because he'd gone bananas. When he received not just a Dear John letter from his girlfriend, but actually a video showing his girlfriend in bed in America, in bed with a sort of hairy peacemaker. And the guy went absolutely bomb. He ran out into the jungle shooting at anything that moved until he finally, American comrades caught him and calmed him down. And then they said, well, you know, you better go and have some R&R and relax a little bit because there's too much. These are stories that you do not find in American newspapers or didn't find in American newspapers or books. So anyway, these two guys were exchanging their experiences and developed an enormous amount during this trip, during this ride from Saigon to Pleiku in the Central Highlands, a great sympathy. And so when I lost sight of them, they were walking sort of the American with his arms around the Vietnamese, and the Vietnamese had carrying his cage with the canary and walking back to the front and back to be shot at and to make war. That was a very compelling story. It also showed how little really, under normal circumstances, the two cultures knew of each other or were seemed compatible with one another.
A prominent historical figure on the side of the North was a fellow named General Jopp, who after the war had a tremendous amount of enjoyment brought his way by continually pointing out how he had manipulated the American press and in turn had manipulated public opinion about the war. And I'm sure this is why you discuss in Duke the dangers of a democracy engaging in a protracted military endeavor. Why did you include that in the book?
Let me just go back to one but very important factor about General Jopp. General Jopp, who was, by the way, a former school teacher, who then became the overall commander of the Viet Minh forces in the First Indochina War, and finally, of course, the North Vietnamese and Viet Cong forces, and the Second Indochina War, and the American Viet. Jopp predicted that the enemy, meaning Western democracies in this case, would not be politically and psychologically capable of fighting a protracted war to its victorious end, simply because they don't have the patience. And this proved to be the case in Vietnam, and very much the case, and it's still proving the case now. Jopp is sure it is proven right again in Afghanistan. Now, let's go back again to Vietnam. When I first got there in 1965, there was a British military advisor by the name of Sir Robert Thompson, who had just concluded and played a major role in the insurrection in British Malaya, communist insurrection. And he designed a strategy that would assure those who were not communists of the protection and also security provided by, in this particular case, the British, and their Malayan allies, non-communist Malayan allies. So, and the closeness between the military and the civilians in a war of that particular nature, that requires an enormous amount of patience, can go on for years. It wasn't very expensive in terms of lives, simply because what they did was they established fortified hamlets. They moved people into safe areas where they could be protected, and then they took on the communists who stayed outside the those protected villages, and then you could fight the communists. And then of course the communists were inferior militarily than their Western counterparts, but they could no longer terrorize the civilians. I met Sir Robert in a very early in January, February of 1965, and asked him about a good example of where his tactics were being put into place in South Vietnam. And associates sent me to a village near the Cambodian border called Long Cot, and I'm describing in this book how it functioned and how everything went well, where the local South Vietnamese commander would not enter a hamlet armed, saying an officer is a gentleman does not enter somebody's home carrying a gun. So before he entered the village, he handed his sidearm to one of his soldiers who stayed outside. And he said, and then I said, well, don't you fear that the communists in that village, he knew, of course, every communist in the village by name, he said that they would do you harm. He said, they wouldn't do harm because that would violate etiquette. It would violate basic standards of civilized behavior. I mean, this guy was in total control. He had an intelligence service reaching right across the border into Cambodia. He knew exactly when the Viet Cong came across the border, the supplies of rice or arms or anything like that from North Vietnam. Thompson left, and the British closed down that mission because Robert McNamara, the American Secretary of Defense at the time, and Lyndon Johnson and others, could not see that the United States would participate in a protracted low-level war in Indochina going on for maybe 10, 20 years. So then they did the opposite. They brought in General Westmoreland, and who was a former tank commander, and ultimately 500,000 American soldiers. But these American soldiers, they were valiant fighters. Many of them were doing a militarily wonderful job. Most of them, I have the highest respect for them, and later worked as a chaplain for Vietnam veterans in Minnesota. So I got to know them extremely well. But it was, of course, foolish, because what were these guys doing? They went in. They had big unit operations. Then they withdrew and left the South Vietnamese civilian population at night in the hands of the Viet Cong, who sneaked back and then slaughtered everybody who was prepared to work with the Americans or the South Vietnamese or others. And the only ones who followed roughly this Robert Thompson theory were the South Koreans, who had two divisions and a brigade there. They knew that it was imperative to protect the civilians and make sure that no Viet Cong ever got there in their way, which, by the way, had sometimes a rather rough scene there, where some little Viet Cong who hadn't understood that where the Koreans were, you better get out of it, because it can only mean trouble. He, when I went on patrol with a South Korean unit, and he fired at us, a sniper, the platoon leader, South Korean, the lieutenant, stripped down to the waist and crawled up a palm tree where this guy sat, you know, and the next thing you knew was that a head came down and then the rump of the body, and that was the end of that Viet Cong. He beheaded them with a taekwondo chop, and that was that. So they provided, in a very, very tough sort of way, security, and within the secure borders, the Vietnamese could then live normally without fear of Viet Cong terror. That part, I believe, has never been properly understood by the general public in the United States.
You've witnessed much, you've suffered much, you've carried a lot of these memories with you, and you've finally released them in this work. But after all of that, other than for the sake of a good dry martini, Uwe, what gets you out of bed in the morning?
Well, look, what gets me out of bed is basically my sardonics. Well, it's a combination beautifully tied together. It's my Lutheran faith and my Christian faith, of course, and my sardonic sense of humor. I don't know what gets me out. First, I get up twice. You know, at my age, I'm 76. You men have to get up at least once a night somewhere. You know?
Yes.
And so then the issue is how do you fall asleep again. So at that time, then the sardonic side of me comes out, and I say my prayers, and when I wake up the second time, the second awakening seems to be the better one. Is the sardonic sense of humor, what nonsense will become our way next? How can you fight it? And who will listen to you? And I find, actually, when I talk to the much younger people, those under 30, that they want to hear what I have to say. What is missing is the power of transmission. I mean, you're one now, KFUO, thank God for that. But it is very hard to make yourself heard. Now, if you get up in the morning and you think of the world you live in, you think, for example, that in France there are now demonstrations, and rather powerful demonstrations, against this crazy law allowing same-sex marriages, you know. Crazy law instituted by a president who has sired four children with the same woman he hasn't married. But he wants that the homosexuals who can't sire children should get married. So, I mean, who demonstrates against them? It's people mainly under the age of 30. And what do they say? They say, you have left us without values. And as the students here, a friend of mine at teaching at Concordia University Irvine says, my students are telling us, we've been left abandoned. A sense of abandonment by a self-serving, by the sort of self-serving baby boomer generation, with whom I have the misfortune of now having to share my geezerdom. The baby boomer generation leaving their children without a sense of value, other than saying, oh, everything's okay and just have to be divorced and be nice. So that's one thing. Secondly, and that is also the punchline of my book, secondly, there is, of course, the knowledge of a Christian that we are not the masters of history. We are not the Lord of history. There is another Lord of history. And it's very, very, very interesting, Roland, that when I talk to my Vietnamese friends, I'm very close to the Vietnamese community, even those who are not Christians, but most of them are theists at least, will acknowledge that and say, yes, we know that we are not the Lord of history. And Lord of history, Lord of history is another one. And that gives you a lot of comfort. And the third thing is that as long as we have a voice, and in my particular case, 10 fingers, two of which I use for typing, to type my copy, write it. Write it, and then see how it is received by the people out there. And then, of course, it is perhaps my Germanic conviction that one must not accept nonsense BS. You have to fight. You have to fight, and you have to knock it down, you have to get up again and tell the truth. The truth as you have seen it, and I believe that what I'm telling in my book is the truth about Vietnam. It is not a very pretty truth for Americans who do not wish to have their own national character besmirched by something like that, but I'm not besmirching American national character. It has been besmirched by those who abandoned South Vietnam, who are abandoning now the Afghans who agitate on behalf of people who wish to kill their offspring rather than of the values that the world thought were the quintessential American values, which were Christian values and then, of course, democratic values. And it has to be said, and I don't care if they kick me out of this country, I'll still say it. It is a very, very important thing to say, and we have to do it.
You know, Uwe, it's hard to believe how quickly the time is flying here this afternoon. After this break for the news, Uwe, let's talk a little bit more about the international flavor of the Vietnam War. Dr. Uwe Simonetto's new Vietnam memoir is called Duk, and we've barely scratched the surface of this very important story. So stay with us. I'm Roland Lettner, and this is Studio A on the Messenger of Good News Worldwide, KFUO.